here. Good evening, everyone. My name is Rubina, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rubina.
Thank you for being here tonight. It's really good to be downtown. I've had a delicious meal, and I'm ready to talk. And it is good to be here on a Sunday night, you know, or any night, because where else would I be? I would be alone. I would be watching TV or passed out or something, but I don't have to be lonely anymore, because that left the minute that I came into this program. I only have one story. It changes, actually, because I like to do an up-to-date on it. So I'll just qualify as an alcoholic first and just get that little part over to prove that I have this progressive disease. And progressive is the key word here, because that's what has come to light in my life. And I have found out firsthand that it is a progressive disease and that it kills or drives us insane, or what's the other thing that we do is we come to meetings on a Sunday night, on a nice August evening. I started life out in England during the war, and I was quite happy with that, because even though the war was going on, I had this is very important, I don't know why it is, but I had a little house there. It had been bombed before, but they had rebuilt it, and I had a front door, back door, okay? Life was good. And at the age of six, after, you know, post-war, my parents lived here before decided, no, we got to get me and my brother back to Canada. This is where they wanted to raise us. So we came to Canada and landed here in December of 49. And I lived in the east end of Montreal. I got beat up every day because I was mostly anglais. I lost my accent real fast. And there was snow. It was bloody cold. And I lost that little house. That little house was very important to me. And I lived above Rand's Tavern. I proceeded to live above other taverns, which I shall tell you. But Rand's was the first one. I didn't even know what a tavern was or apartments were, and my brother didn't either. He's 4 years older than me, and he used to go wandering into other people's houses, into their apartments. He didn't understand the apartment, you know. Anyways, that was the first thing. The other thing that happened when I came to this country, which, you know, I had a chip on my shoulder from age six. That's pretty early, but it was a real chip. They put me back into grade one because that was the age that people started to go to school here. I had already been going to school at the age of four, and I knew how to read and write, so I had a chip on the shoulder, okay? I didn't want to go to school. I didn't like school. And so that's when I discovered that I belonged to a violent home. So I grew up in a violent home in the East, and my father, turns out, was an alcoholic, but we didn't know. He was just a drunk then, you know. My mother had him arrested once. It was interesting. But he used to come home, and he used to be able to beat her up, and that was it. And I was the caretaker of the family. But, you know, he'd be okay for 6 months until the shoe dropped, and, you know, then he was drinking for 6 months. And the interesting thing about that is he hated his mother because she was a drunk. He really hated her. It had little to do with her. And my mother was bringing me up to hate my father, you know. It's really interesting, you know. It was not the ideal family situation, and nobody came home. So we kept secrets, and those secrets can kill. Anyway, onward and upward. Life could go, you know, we were always waiting, holding breath if anything happened in the house. And it was my responsibility to call the police and tell them to come back home. And we went from that place and lived above a funeral parlor. That was interesting. And then we moved out to Laval, and we lived above the Texas Tavern. Anybody here know the Texas? Rings a bell, right? I lived upstairs. I hated that place. Hated it. I hated the drunks in there. I hated the smell of beer. Never did smell beer. Drink beer. I drank hard stuff. Much easier. So I learned to drink at home so that I would learn how to drink and not get into trouble, right? So, I was taught not to mix my drinks, because if I mixed them, I would get sick. So I drank straight, and I started out on rum. So, chip on shoulder, she leaves school at 15, and she goes to work. Oh, whole new life out there, you know, but I'm very introverted. I'm very, very shy. And as I worked out, you know, in those days, we used to dress up when we went to work. We weren't allowed to wear pants or anything, so we had to dress up and all that sort of thing. Downtown, I went to the Monterey, I went to the Bellevue Casino. I went to all great places where I learned how to drink more. And I was having a good time. I also had a capacity for it. And I loved the taste. So I'm not talking about being an alcoholic because I felt sorry for me. I just like the taste, and I like more, plain and simple. My brother, who was older than me, you know, I heard you speak about this book earlier, Larry. He got a book in 1959. He was sober 1 year. He went out and disappeared for 17 years. You know, this is an insidious disease. Anyways, moving on. Great capacity for alcohol. Not a party girl. You know, I didn't go out I drank too much, you know. And I would, my head would spin. So, you know, I was very nervous and very, very shy. I would, what is it? I met my first husband. There were two of them. Met the first one when I was 17 and got married at 19, knew everything, right? That's what you did in those days. And this man didn't drink. He couldn't drink because it made him sick. My first husband was Oriental, and it made him sick and made his face red. So during the marriage, which lasted about almost 8 years, I drank very little. And that's where I get to the progressive part. Because up until I married him, I would drink or whatever, you know, not excessively, didn't get drunk or whatever. I just liked drinking. But my disease was already there, and it had progressed. And by the time I left him, I thought, oh, now I can do what I want. At this point in time, my mother was living with me because my father had tried to do her in just one more time. And she was living with me. And my mother was blind. I was her eyes all her life. I was born, she was considered blind then. At the time of my birth, but and my mother had learned to drink. I'll just tell you very quickly in a nutshell. My mother started to drink at the age of 50 to get back at the old men. She got sober at 80, and she spent the next 8 years as the best 8 years of her whole entire life. And I think that's pretty special. You know, that really is special. But anyway, so here I am, separated. With my son, 4 and a half, and my mother. And I said, we're going to do what we need to do. And we know how to live because we see it on television. And those people come home and they have cocktails. So I'm going to buy my rum and I'll get the bloody port wine for her. God, that stuff is awful. And I put it on the shelf and it was going to be there and we could be genteel and have a drink. That, the progression of drinking had gone to the point where within just a few weeks, I was drinking the whole bottle of rum over the weekend. Along comes this man that I meet. I went to work for this man, and several months later, I started going out with him. Well, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven because he drank the way real people should drink, you know. And we started the relationship, and I was the other woman. Sorry about that, but I was the other woman. And for a long time, that was the way it was. I can't change the story. That's just the way it is. So, but he used to take very good care of me and my mother. And he would send up cases of stuff, like a case of vodka, a case of scotch. Then I became a scotch drinker. So the scotch would come up, the wine for my mother. He knew how to take care of the old lady. And, you know, all these things. And we had cases of, heck, isn't that great? And then we would travel, and we would travel lots of places, go to Bermuda for the weekend, go here and there. We traveled extensively. It was a great life. And you know, it's that cunning and baffling part of it that really takes you along the merry way, you know. And all of our photographs, all in the hotel rooms, there was always everything, all these bottles around, you know, they were all over the place, you know. And people would say, you drank all that stuff? And you say, well, yes. And, but, you know, we were having a good time. I didn't know that you could make cocktails in cars and have, you know, drink and drive in those days, you know. Times have changed. Anyway, I got a very good job. I really landed a great job and for an American company. I was in sales. I was always working hard. And I had to travel a great deal. And I also worked from home. Isn't that perfect? You know, head office in Toronto, another one in New York, and I worked from Dollard to Zorma. This is fine. I don't have to show up in the morning. Don't have to be anywhere, but I do my job. I was good at my job. But how come is it, you know, that I always felt like I was cheating? Even though I produced and I sold and I did, there's always that feeling of inadequacy that I wasn't good enough. Maybe one day I'm going to wake up and they're going to find out, you know, something. But that's just that the inferiority that I had about myself. And especially because I hadn't finished school. Well, I went to Georgia a few times, but it was pretty boring at night, you know. And it was cold in the winter, so I would go home. Anyways, aside from that, so here I am working and I'm traveling. Well, I was drinking a great deal at that point. Suffice it to say, I drank between 25 and 40 ounces a day. That is a lot of booze for a woman, and it doesn't take very long before it acts on you. Some years later, my alcoholism lasted for 10 years, and towards the end, I couldn't stand it anymore. And I said to myself, when I get as bad as my brother, I'll stop. You know, I didn't know about the invisible line then. The invisible line. But I knew that if I got as bad as him, you know, it's time to stop. But they don't tell you where the line is. That's the trouble. And I must have crossed it somewhere. And drinking wasn't fun anymore. Drinking had to be. And, you know, I lived alone with my son. And I was hiding it from me so that my boyfriend, this man, wouldn't know how much I was drinking. I mean, how sick is that, you know? I would not leave my hotel, like I traveled a lot, I wouldn't leave my hotel room in the morning until I'd thrown up twice. And then I would stop shaking, you know. So, and I was a slow drinker, so I had to start early. I must have gone in reeking places, you know. We think it doesn't smell. It's, you know, by that time I graduated to vodka, so you don't smell it. It just oozes out of your body. Getting towards the end of it, and I decide I can't live like this. And I was hoping that there was something wrong with my brain. There definitely was something wrong with it, but not what I thought. I thought there's something growing in there that would make me stop drinking, and I hoped I would die. I would hope I was getting paranoid. I would be so saturated. You know, when I think of it, and it's amazing to think that how I could lie there in my bed and be paralyzed and feel like I was being sucked out of my body. This is a horrible, horrible feeling. I ended up at the hospital once. My son had to drive from the age of 12. That's bad. He would drive home sick shift because he wouldn't let me drive. Anyway, so that's another story. So end of drinking is coming, and I thought, I don't care what happens, but if I don't stop drinking, my son is going to hate me too, the way my father hated his mother and the way that I hated my father. And they live a long time in my family, and I just could not face the rest of a whole lifetime of hatred. So I said, that's it. I phoned downtown. They sent me to the candlelight meeting at Search for Serenity in Roxborough, and I walked up those stairs. I literally flew out of the house. My last drink, I knew, it was 11 minutes after 7 that Friday night, January 2nd. I didn't care what anybody said. I realized one day that nobody made me drink. It was nobody's fault, just me. I was the one that picked it up and put it down my throat. And I went to that meeting, and there were 22 people around that table with the candles going. And I had never felt so at home in my whole life. I recognized every single face, although I'd never seen them before. I was home. At last they said to me, would you like to say something, Rabina? And I said, yeah. I said, I've got to be an alcoholic because I just can't have one drink. And I wanted it. You know, every time I hear how it works, it is so simple. That is how it works, you know. And I took everything so literally, and I got a sponsor. And I couldn't believe that somebody, a stranger, would care about me, that would call me the next day and say, are you all right? Do you think that you can go without a drink? I mean, these things just didn't happen in any other circumstance I had been familiar with. So here I am, and I'm going to meetings because all of a sudden I don't want to let these people down. You know, they mean something, and I seem to mean something to them. I had this sponsor, and would you believe she lived in the next parking lot? You know, it just so happened that way. And I was with Dollar then. The man that I was going out with, I still continued to see him, but I told him that he should choke on the liquor, that he wasn't drinking it around me. I was, you know, not very polite, but I meant it. He drank for another 2 years. He came to me and said that he was going to give up alcohol. I'm really cutting this short, okay? Because I want to get the good stuff. But he gave up alcohol, and he was a very sick man at this point. And we got married 2 years later. So we were, at that point, together 13 and a half years by the time we got married. And life was good. Everything had changed. You know, I did what it said. I got a sponsor. I went to meetings. I went to intensive weekends. I remember finding my higher power about 6 months after I got into the program. And I would have believed, and I was willing to do anything. And I have and had certain spiritual beliefs that were particularly mine, definitely not religious at all, but definitely spiritual beliefs. But I was willing to let everything go if I could get sober. And I remember I was about 6 months sober, and I felt a little light going, like just like a match, like a little flame going on inside here. I didn't know what it was. It had to be love, and it had to be something for me. And I knew that I was going to be okay. But I was willing to go to any length. I had to let the old person go. And even all these years later, I'm still having to let go of who I had become 2 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and become that other person that is with me that I can become if I don't have fear, if I have faith. And I believe that when we come into this fellowship, and when we find ourselves coming down the back stairs of these churches, we have been given an opportunity to become that person that we were meant to be if we only let go. And it's not easy. It's not. But we can if we have faith, and there's enough people around to catch us and help us and guide us around along the way. So I've been able to do that. So I realized that what my sponsor told me too, whatever you do believe will come back tenfold. And it's true. And it wasn't what she believed. She believed entirely different, but that's the freedom we have to believe what we want that is good for us in this program. And it's truly, truly a gift for anyone. And I like to think it's kind of magic, you know. You come down these stairs and you get a little shot of magic, you know, the fairy dust comes over you and you were able to go out there and face another day or another night. You know, it feels good. So I went to my meetings and so forth, and then we got married the same weekend that they had the big international, that was in 1985. I got sober January 2nd in 1981, and like I said, I waited till after Christmas and New Year before I flew into these doors. And life is good, and the two of us were getting sober. You know, like he was 2 years behind me, but he was getting sober, and he was doing this. He was older than me too. He came from a European background also, and he said that anybody that he had to make amends to, they were all dead anyway. You know, and maybe so. And it's not always wise to share everything with your partner or your mate. You know, because that's too easy. It has to be with somebody else outside. And I really do believe that, too. He never had a sponsor. So a couple of years after that, we went to Ontario, into Lancaster. We had this great house that we built on the water and so forth, and he would come into Montreal every day. Life was good. And sometimes we would go to the West Shore discussion group out in the West Island on Tuesday night. I'd drive in and so forth. And years passed. We traveled a lot. Excellent. I quit that job. I didn't quit. You know, it was something happened in the industry and it just evolved. And I was already making. I had my own business. I was making lingerie by this time out in Lancaster. We were both in the fashion industry. So he said to me, he says, you know, I don't know. He says, I'm getting kind of tired. He said, going to the meetings all the time. You know, driving in Montreal down to St. Patrick Street and so forth. So we stopped, he says, I'm not going to be going to the meeting so often. Graduated meetings for 4 years. And I missed it, but we used to meditate together. We used to do all these things together. But you know what happens when you don't go to the meetings? Something happens, and you stop doing certain things. You stop. There's something missing. There's just something missing when you don't go. And I guess it was early in 1999. He was 16 years sober then. And early in 1999, in the spring, I noticed something different about him. And I didn't know quite what it was. But some light had gone off. There was a distance, and I felt a remoteness. And there was, something was pulling him away. And I got to, I was working a lot, trying to make my shop and the business going. And, you just lose touch. And you're not grounded anymore. And I remember during the summer, I thought he had been drinking because he acted different. But he denied it and said, no, there wasn't a chance, you know. And we had an agreement with each other that if either one of us had picked up a drink again, the other one could leave. And I firmly believed this. You know, this was a pact that we had made. But he denied it. So, but his belief had gone and his disappointment had gone. And this is, we're all individual and we have our personal path that we have to go along. But there was a time that I said, Rob, you're drinking, I'm sure. No, he denied it twice. We went on a trip in November. And then not long after we were back, he went out of the house one day and he never came back. He died. Just like that. And I was alone, without, with a dying business and so forth. And long story short, I lost my house, my husband, and my business in 18 months. How do you get through that? You get through it because by absolute fortune, somebody phones you up and says, Rubina, we haven't seen you. I'd like to go and see John take a cake. I said, yeah, I think I would. And I went back to my meeting. I drove in from Ontario every week. And I was home again. And I said, never will I let myself be taken away from my meetings again. They're that important to me. But there is just nothing in the world that you can't get through without the help of this program. There are people around who support, who have kindness, who care, who will pick up the phone and speak to you. But the magic of this program was that, well, before that, about 6 months later, after when I was thinking of selling the house, I found the empty bottles. And if you had heard the primal cry that came out of me, it was horrible. It was horrible. It was devastating. And I went into a very dark place. I learned that that wasn't my dark place, that was his dark place. But because I've had enough program and really put it into practice and learning how to turn things over, getting in touch with my higher power and believing absolutely that I am here for some other reason, whatever reason it is, that I have purpose, I was able to forgive him and to fall in love with him all over again, And forgiving is so essential. You say the word forgive, and then what does it mean? But we somehow find a way to actually do that. We let somebody go, or we understand, and we have learned the steps through practicing the steps, through reading the stories in the big book, and by coming to these meetings and listening or sharing exactly what it means to live as a whole, healthy, well-balanced person. We get off kilter. We're extremely sensitive people. We're emotional. Thank goodness. We feel. And we can feel it, and we can have pain, and we don't have to bloody drink. This is amazing. This is where the fairy dust gets all sprinkled around, And we've paid a price. Like you say, Larry, we have paid a price to get in here. And even if people have slipped, this is where we belong. You come back. This is what the disease is. It only gets worse, And my husband proved. But I want you to know, I understand that that was a conscious decision that he did. I know that he did that, and I understand why and the ramifications. But that was his personal journey. He had to do what he had to do. I also had the emotional well-being to see that that was his journey. I would never have been able to do that. Changes will keep on happening. My son was down in the States, and I have no other family. My brother is still alive, and he lives out west. He's doing very well, thank you. He actually works for, he's part of the British Columbia Mental Health Council, would you believe, now. You know, he found himself in under a bridge one day and decided to do something about it. So, you know, there is hope. By God, there is hope. And isn't that wonderful when you know that people survive, that people get well, that there is happiness, and that, because, you know, a friend of mine said to me recently, Rebecca, why are you still being here? I said, because we have a good time. Where do you go and have a good time? We laugh. We laugh at ourselves, and we're allowed to. And we need the newcomer. We need the people who have a hard time. We immediately go back to that point within a moment and feel compassion when somebody's having a difficult time, because we remember, oh, that's what we need to do. I'm on another journey now. As a matter of fact, I'm fulfilling wishes. Just recently somebody said to me, my girlfriend said to me, now, don't you think you're getting a little too old to have those wishes? Now, isn't that wishful thinking? I said, absolutely, it's wishful. And every wish I've ever had has come true. And so I'm doing things that I still, you know, the type A personality. I didn't know that a lot of alcoholics are type A, but I guess I fit in. You know, I want to succeed. I want to accomplish that which I came here to do. What is my, I don't have to fear or feel unworthy. I do have value now. I'm comfortable with myself. I go back, I'm back to school. I'm working on my second certificate now at Concordia. You know, terrified at 59 to go back. Absolutely terrified. Got lost the first night, you know, like shaking. And now I can't stop going to school. I love it, you know. I finished one book. It's not published, but working on that. And working on a second. And I've become an artist, you know. These are dreams. And you're allowed to dream. And you're allowed to feel everything. You must never forget that child that's within. So many of us have lost childhood, these parts of us, and all the dreams and everything. We come in here, and we can get those back. And all you have to do is ask for it. Hey, you say, hey, you know. Like, for instance, nobody here has seen my garden. Well, I have a magical garden. No other word for it. And I said, because I don't have enough money, but I said, you know, God, I really need a garden, you know, and I'm willing to barter, you know, whatever it is that I have to do. I go, I meet this lady. This is last year. I meet this little filler lady at Walmart, and she's saying she's got too many flowers. And I said, really? I could use some. She says, come to my house. That's Helen's part of the garden. She must have given me 20 pieces. I meet another lady. They give me little pieces. This is what you do. You open up your mouth. You don't have to be afraid anymore. I met this lady recently, and I talked to her, and I said, what do you call that plant? She says, come and see the rest of my garden. She has an amazing, I mean, life is good, right? I'm talking about gardens now, and we're that day meeting. But it is how you take care of your garden, how we take care of the garden within us. We're planting, how we're reaping, and to see things grow, you know? So I go and see her garden, and this lady is from Hong Kong, and she said, isn't this nice? We're talking to each other. I said, yes. And she said, you know, people are so afraid of everybody else. They think they're going to eat you, you know. And I laughed so much because I'd heard that expression before many years ago. People are afraid to talk to each other, not in these rooms. You have a problem, you come in, you state your problem. I still have problems. I have great problems, but even right now, I want it all, okay, every bit of it. I want to know that whatever I've had in my sobriety has been worth it. So I am willing, oh God, I'm on the brink of something these days. And you know, I'm pushing 64, and I'm going, oh yes, what do I do? I'm going to jump in. I'm going to take my chances, okay? I'm going to go for it. Who knows where I'll end up? But if I don't, then I'm letting myself down. And everything I do and everything I share with you tonight is what I've learned in here. And it's absolute belief that there is abundance all around us. All we have to do is ask for it. We have to acquiesce. Remember Scotty, you know, telling us to surrender? You know, these wonderful people that have these wonderful beautiful names like white and black-haired Linda and so and so and so and so. We have all these names in this program. It's great, the anonymity. We come in here from different sectors and we're welcomed, we're cherished, and we go our merry way for the rest, you know, the next 24 hours. So there's so much hope, there's so much belief, and it ain't over. And I'm going to pack as much as I can into this as possible. And I want to thank you all for inviting me here. I don't know if I've gone on too much or whatever, but I hope I've helped somebody here tonight. And I wish you all a very successful and healthy and abundant 24 hours.
Thank you.